Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we try to understand unspeakable acts from the Cleveland kidnappings to the Boston bombing to Joseph Kony to Abu Ghraib, my next guest has looked over to the dark side as closely as he could. In a new book, human rights advocate James Dawes writes about his interviews with confessed war criminals. His book, Evil Men, seeks answers to how human beings allow themselves to commit atrocities. James Dawes is director of the program in human rights and humanitarianism at McAllister College. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
These were Japanese war criminals from the Second Sino-Japanese War. That's 1937 to 1945. So these would be very old men if they're alive today. When did these interviews take place?
They took place about 5 years ago. And indeed, they were old and they were frail. And sometimes it was hard to keep in mind with these emaciated and feeble men how powerful and monstrous they had been so many decades before.
These men committed torture and rape and the worst of the worst things we can imagine, because I don't want to shrink from the context in which we're really talking. Can you give me a range of what the men you interviewed did?
They did anything you can imagine. I mean, any story we've heard from the atrocities of war, they committed, and they committed it over a long period of time. It went from, as you said, murder, torture, rape, to things like kidnapping civilians and performing malicious medical experiments on them while they were unsedated. And they did these not as sort of berserk moments where they, under the stress of combat, lost it, but over years as a part of who they were proud of being.
Why did you want to speak to them?
I wanted to speak to them because I wanted to understand evil better. I think, like most people, I understand evil as a kind of cognitive event. You turn on the news, you read the newspaper, and you have to come to grip with evil as an idea. But the opportunity to get closer and to meet the perpetrators and to see the world through their eyes and maybe even get close enough to see part of yourself in their eyes, it seemed like an opportunity to learn something. And so I and a wonderful New York-based photographer, Adam Nadell, went there for that purpose.
And so after looking at your book, is it fair to say that one of your main conclusions is that ordinary people can be trained for extraordinary atrocity, trained, like put them in a strange and frightening environment with unclear roles, with little or no regulation, I think you've said. How central a thought is that to your book?
It's central. I think what struck me most about these men was how ordinary they were, and in fact how well-oiled the machine is for making ordinary men like this into monsters. It's really a four-step process that all nations have down pat. You start with boys, because boys are easy to take apart. All personalities are, in a sense, easy to deconstruct, but young boys are the easiest.
Young boys more than young girls?
I do think gender has a component. I mean, a great deal of the violence that they started with was violence against women, and that was important to their training. Purifying themselves mm-hmm. in an all-male order organized as violence against women was important.
Can you tell me the story of an individual, one man, and the atrocities he committed? And again, don't shrink from saying what he did, but then what you learned by interviewing him about how he got to that point?
So there was one man who, I guess I think about him because I liked him. I mean, he was funny, he was charming, he was in his 80s, and so also vulnerable, which made me feel compassion for him. And he had this big, goofy Mary Poppins bicycle he would ride around, and there was just something about him that just made him instantly likable. And so we'd sit down, me and Adam, with this sort of tentative feeling of friendship for him, and listen to him tell these stories. And the story that strikes me most, and again, you know, shut me down if this is not appropriate for your audience, but it's what haunts him and haunts me, because it was this moment when he crossed a line that he could never again uncross. And it was when he was relatively early in the war. He describes going into a village with some of the older soldiers. And after everything would settle down militarily, the first thing the older soldiers would want to do would be to find the women in the village. And so he was with one group, and they went to a house, and they found a woman. And they said, "You, Kaneko, you wait outside. We're going to go inside and do what they would do." And when they finished, they came out, and the woman was still alive, but they were dragging her by her hair and her head. And they told Kaneko to pick her up, and they carried her out to the village well. And then they told him to heave her into the well, which he did. And that was shocking. That was hard. That was his first shock. But it was, in some sense, I think, for Kaneko, easier than what came next, which was that he heard a sort of noise. And to this day, he must have been in some sort of surreal, disassociated state, because he had trouble understanding if the noise was coming from inside his head or outside. But reconstructing the story, it seems clear the noise was the sound of a stool being dragged across the cobble of the village, and it was this boy, this four-year-old boy, who had been in that house with his mom when they had done what they had done to her, and who had watched as they tossed her into this well. And that boy was scared, and he just wanted to be with his mom because he was so scared. And so he went up to the well, and he couldn't reach. So he got the stool and got on the stool and cried to his mom, and just again, he wanted to be next to her because he was frightened, so he jumped into the well.
Oh.
And then they blew it up. They threw a grenade in the well and said, "This is it, we're done," and walked away.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's one of those stories that, I mean, I had to kind of pry out of him. It's a shocking story, but, you know, I'm not interested in shock. Shock seems sort of a fleeting emotion. It's almost exploitative, and so I have some anxiety about talking about these stories. But I think his view and my view is that, you know, this is the truth of what happens in war. It is the truth, and we sort of have an ethical obligation to look and not to look away.
And so, and this is the reason that I asked you to describe an incident, and I didn't know which you were going to describe, and I guess I hadn't read that one in the book, and it caught me speechless when you talked about the grenade going down there. But again, as I said before the initial question, I only ask you to describe the extent of one of his atrocities, because I want to understand how much you were able to get to, how he understood it, how what we can learn from him, if anything, and maybe it's nothing, about how a human being gets to that point where they're capable of doing such a thing.
I think we could learn a lot, and then we can learn a lot about how to stop people from doing it. The way they're made is pretty simple. You isolate them. You teach them to see the world as a series of binaries, us versus them, safe versus unsafe. You teach them that there are simple solutions to these binaries. These simple solutions often involve violence. Then you train them, and the training involves physically beating them down with a system of harsh punishments and arbitrary rewards so that they begin to feel helpless. They're taught just to be helpless to the system that is beating them down. And then the final step is the most important step for atrocity, which is that it's incremental. It is stage by stage. The first time you were asked to slap a villager or to verbally abuse someone, it might feel hard. The first time you were asked to stab a corpse to practice how to use your bayonet, it might feel hard. But the second time, it's easier. The third time, it's easier. And by the end, every man I spoke to, they were doing these things with kind of a casual, almost pride, in the hopes that it would bring them advancement.
Human rights advocate James Dawes, my guest on WNYC, his new book called Evil Men, for which he interviewed a group of confessed war criminals from the Sino-Japanese War, 1937 to 1945. He just interviewed them as old men about 5 years ago, as he's told us. May I ask if you learned from these interviews that war crimes tended to come from training and experience and culture? Why do you use the word evil in the title of the book? Evil sounds like something more intrinsic to a person, or something more binary, to use a word that you use, like either you are evil or either you are good. Politicians abuse this. Why evil?
I think that's absolutely right. Evil is a word that tends to silence. It is a word that tells us to stop thinking, that once something is called evil, it's named a mystery, and it's put beyond the pale of analysis, or beyond the pale of the human, really. And And that's dangerous. I think that's unuseful. And so part of my hope was to say evil isn't the end point of our thinking. Evil has to be the starting point. And I do think there are things that shock our conscience and that aren't adequately described by words like bad or wicked. Or I think there are philosophical distinctions when you reach this level of atrocity. But I think my hope is that we can begin to see evil as a much more complicated process.
Talking about that one man earlier, you said, I liked him. I had compassion for him. I had feelings of friendship for him. Were you conflicted about experiencing such feelings for somebody who was a war criminal and did the things that you know that he did?
It was incredibly confusing. I shared this film with the photographer. We would, you know, all these men, most of the time we'd enter their homes and we'd meet their children and their grandchildren. We'd share gifts. We'd sit down, sometimes share food. And we were interviewing them. So, as you know, you try to warm people up a bit. We'd make jokes and laugh together. And if you were watching us on a TV screen, for all the world, if you had the mute button pressed, it would look like we were just visitors talking about their grandchildren. But instead, we were talking about how they murdered other people's grandchildren. And that huge gulf between the gentle intimacies we were sharing and the just monstrous things we were talking about is something that I'm still trying to work out personally, and the book is part of that.
Did they experience or communicate to you remorse?
Absolutely. And this is the sort of final twist in their story, which makes it even more complicated. They were captured, and they were put in prison camp in China, what the U.S. called at the time, and I guess still calls, Chinese brainwashing camp. And they were taught there that what they had done was wrong. They were taught through techniques, very powerful techniques of psychological coercion, to be sort of evangelical pacifists and communists. And they came home with this mission. I mean, the reason they continue living each day, bearing the weight of what they've done, is because they feel it's their mission to tell the world what Japan did in China, because many people in Japan still want to deny it, and to tell the world what happens when you send boys to war. I think they were very concerned about me as an American, because Americans tend to send people to war without really knowing what happens there, and they wanted the details to be front and center in our vision.
Do you think a war criminal in the battlefield or occupation context like these men is different from the kind of people who've been in the news lately, like an Adam Lanza or the Aurora movie theater shooter, James Holmes, or the accused Cleveland kidnapper, Ariel Castro?
I think there's some key differences. I mean, first I should say about the news happening now, I, like everybody else, am reacting on a purely emotional level, and I find it hard to be analytic about that. But what I would say is that the men I met were ordinary men who, if they hadn't been taken away and shipped off and trained, they would have lived regular lives and been good neighbors and maybe even virtuous citizens. They were not self-inventing monsters. They were made. They were made deliberately and expertly by the machinery that makes people do this in wartime.
And you think these individual criminals have been in the news recently here are different from that, or more self-made? Is that the phrase you used?
I mean, I think self-made maybe implies too much agency to them. Sometimes,
yeah,
when you look at these people, it almost looks like the blossoming of a broken genetic destiny. But they're not the products of a system. They did what they did in secrecy, in a culture that let them know every moment that what they were doing shouldn't be happening. The men I met were doing what they did in a culture that told them every moment, take pride in this, compete over this, succeed at this.
But also, somebody led those cultures. So what about a Saddam Hussein or a Joseph Kony or a Hitler? That psychology must be different then.
Right. And I think that at the level, however, in a sense, it's how close you get to the bodies. So the perpetrators I met tended to be people who were, you know, vivisecting the patients or attacking the women or shooting the children. And that's a very different experience from the people who get to play out their personal psychoses at the level of grand design. And I think in some sense, even though the people doing the most violent actions on the field are the most active in that sense, they're the most helpless also.
Before you go, are there policy implications from your work? You're a human rights advocate, so you must hope to apply what you've learned somehow to prevent such atrocities in the future.
I think so. I mean, in a sense, it's simply inverting the process that I described before. Raising people, training people to tolerate ambiguity and living in the gray rather than seeking a world that's defined by simple and clear binaries. This is important. I think training people not to feel helpless and subject to a brutal reward and punishment system, but training them that they have agency and they can make choices that matter. And also, perhaps most important, I mean, this is even, you know, this works at public radio, incremental movement toward altruism, giving people opportunities in small ways each step to sacrifice themselves for a good cause, even if it's something that's donating to public radio, say, that makes each further step of heroism and moral courage easier to contemplate and easier to do. And so the more we know about how monsters are made, it's really just a matter of reversing that process for producing heroes.
How about sending more women into war? We've had this big debate in this country just recently about women on the front lines. Do you think they'd be less susceptible to being trainable for these kinds of atrocities?
This is, I mean, I think we're very in a disturbing but also interesting moment as this is beginning to happen. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now is that the gender dynamic of violence against women tends to simply be occurring all over against our own troops at the same time. And so we're not yet at a system where women are equal and have entire access to all the things men have in the military. When that happens, I think we might see some change. So long as women are, in a certain sense, unequal citizens of the military, you might simply see the continuation of this dynamic of gendered violence.
James Dawes is director of the program in Human Rights and Humanitarianism at McAllister College. His new book is called Evil Men. Thank you for having this kind of difficult conversation with us. I appreciate you jumping in.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk to Lindy West, staff writer for Jezebel and author of How to Be a Person. She'll preview tonight's Green Space event on how you know you're a grown-up woman. How do you know? We'll take your calls, too. Stay with us.